I made a terrible, terrible mistake. And I'm here with you today to apologize and to ask for forgiveness. When I listen to that tape, I don't even know how I could say words like that. I'm not a racist. I love people. I always have. But those words came out of my mouth, I guess. And I'm so sorry.
Clippers owner Donald Sterling with his now famous, or maybe infamous, apology to CNN's Anderson Cooper over his racist remarks that were caught on tape. And now it seems those remarks have cost him his team. Today, there are reports that Sterling will let his estranged wife, Shelley, negotiate terms for a forced sale of the team. According to various news reports, the sale will only go forward if the league will allow Shelley Sterling to keep some form of ownership. More information has also emerged about the rift between Sterling and his companion, V. Stiviano, that may ultimately cause Sterling to lose his team. Brent Skokenbohr is here to give us an update on the status of the team and its owner, and he writes about sports for USA Today. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thanks. So tell us the latest on this story, and you've confirmed that Sterling has said that he will sell the team?
Yeah, he has authorized his wife, Shelley, to sell the team, and she plans to do so voluntarily. That is, she is trying to sell it without being forced to sell it and trying to keep a stake of the team for herself. She owns 50% right now. This is a lever she apparently is pulling to maintain at least some share of the team ownership. But yes, Mr. Sterling, who is the controlling owner of the Clippers, has agreed to let his wife sell the team. It appears that this is a maneuver to a lever they can pull to try to get something out of it still, and it's not clear that it'll work.
Because the NBA doesn't want Shelley Sterling to have any ownership of it?
Right. They would just as soon wash their hands of the Sterling family, and it is in their power to do that, according to the NBA Constitution. The NBA is really holding all the cards here, and so what we're seeing with the Sterlings is various attempts through their attorneys to get something out of it, either to maintain some share of the team or to extract some kind of settlement. Now, the question is, does the NBA allow this so that it can, you know, maybe get this over quicker or not drag it out or not have to pay so much in attorney's fees? And the NBA has said in response to this news that it is going forward as planned to terminate the ownership of the Clippers.
Well, try to get inside the Sterling's minds if you could. And what is holding them up from selling? Because they stand to make a hefty, hefty profit. The team is worth close to $1 billion, from what I understand.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the family, I think, looks at the Clippers as more than just a business or a financial property. I think they look at it as a family heirloom that they had planned to pass on to their children. They have owned the team since 1981. And besides that, time really is leverage for the Sterlings in this case. They know the NBA wants to get this over as quickly as possible. So the longer that they can drag this out and make it more difficult, they could extract some kind of settlement from the NBA, where the NBA would be inclined to pay them to go away quicker. That's, you know, we know about the litigation history of this family, and so that's really not, that's something that, you know, anybody could see them doing given their history.
And who would step in to buy the team? Who's the most likely buyer at this point?
It's hard to say. There's been so many names out there. It's like, who isn't interested in buying the Clippers? All the celebrity names from Oprah Winfrey and a lot of the big money people in Los Angeles. It's anybody's guess. Does the team go to the highest bidder, or does Shelley Sterling, if this attempt of hers works, does she sell it to somebody she knows? That's another question. I think that the NBA would rather sell the team to somebody it's comfortable with. Of course, they would get approval anyway, but I think the NBA would like control of the sale. But Shelley Sterling would like to control it herself, and that's why she's doing what she's doing.
So the NBA would have to sign off on any buyer?
That's how I understand it, yeah. The NBA has approval rights over who gets to join their club, so to speak. That's common in any pro league. So, yeah, they have that kind of control.
And what are you hearing about the backstory of how this all came to light? There seems to be more and more evidence, if you will, coming out about how, for instance, an employee of the Clippers wanted to warn the NBA of this tape that Vistaviano made of Donald Sterling before it came out, but that didn't happen, and the team president warned the employee not to come forward. What's going on?
Yeah, the Los Angeles Times has done a lot of good reporting on that, and it appears, you know, they're just going off their reporting, they obtained some documents from the NBA about how this all came to light, and it appears that this woman, Vistaviano, whether you call her his archivist is what she said, or his girlfriend, which she denies, apparently was spurned felt spurned because she wasn't given her usual tickets or accommodations at a Clippers game. This is according to text messages that the LA Times got. And in response to that, it appears that she released these recordings or sent it to the Clippers, and the Clippers were aware of these recordings like 2 weeks before they came out publicly, and the Clippers president apparently tried to, you know, have the audio deleted, though there was more than one copy. At this point, these recordings were still private conversations, so it's not like this was some kind of cover-up, because it was just a private recording at the time. It wasn't part of any official investigation. In any event, the tapes got out publicly through TMZ a couple weeks later. It's not clear how TMZ obtained them and from whom, though it's speculated that she gave them to a friend for safekeeping after she was sued by Mrs. Sterling, who was trying to recover some property from Ms. Viviano that she said belonged to her. So it's quite a web that
is.
That has been woven here.
Right. It's very cinematic, or at least TV movie of the week. Brent Schrotenbohr, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thanks a lot.
Brent Schrotenbohr writes for USA Today. We want to hear what you think. Should Shelly Sterling be able to keep some ownership of the team, or should the Sterlings just get out altogether? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join our conversation on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. All right, let's switch gears just a tad. For some people, the idea of going a day or two without a shower is pretty troubling. 4 weeks? Oh, out of the question. But journalist Julia Scott saw it as her duty to try it with the help of a small group of scientists working on a special bacteria that she sprayed on her skin instead of using soap. She writes about this experience and what she learned about the wild frontier of human bacteria treatments for this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Julia Scott, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
How clean are you right now?
I'm gloriously clean.
All right. Well, tell us about this experiment. You were really a test subject for a biotech startup company?
Yes, that's right. The company is called AO Biome, and they're based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they're a biotech startup that decided to pivot into cosmetics when the founder of the company, a chemist named Dave Whitlock, found a bacteria that is based in soil. It's in soil and water. It's called ammonia oxidizing bacteria that he thought might have played an evolutionary role in our own skin microbiome. He hypothesized that this particular bacteria used to live on us because it's so ubiquitous in nature. And he hypothesized there was a reason that it used to help us. And in order to prove his hypotheses, he decided to apply it to himself and go without showering for 12 years to see if the bacteria would indeed thrive on his skin.
Wait, 12 years, did you just say?
Yes.
He hasn't
yes.
taken a shower in 12 years?
That's correct.
And what have been the results of that?
Well, for him, he was able to prove that the bacteria feed off of the ammonia and urea that human sweat naturally produces, and the company contends that the bacteria clean the human skin, leaves it feeling more hydrated and less odorous because bacteria usurp some of the smellier parts of the sweat cycle.
Well, why would you need his spray at all? Why not just not shower or anything, just be natural?
Well, you'd be surprised, Madeline, at how many people have emailed me since the story has come out online telling me that they don't actually do much of that. But, you'd probably smell like a homeless person, I'm guessing.
Oh, I see. So it masks the odor, this spray.
You know, it's not a replacement for bacteria. I would describe it more the way they describe it, which is they say it's an add-on. Like, they're as a company, they're not suggesting that people do what I did, which is to give up their products. They're saying that everybody could use their soaps and shampoos, but that people should reapply the bacteria afterwards so that have the beneficial effects of these bacteria to have their skin feel more hydrated.
Because these products strip us of those beneficial bacteria.
Yes. Not only do they strip us of the ammonia oxidizing bacteria that this company hypothesizes used to live on us before the sanitary revolution and we all got showers inside our homes, but conceivably our cleaning products may strip us of an unknown number of beneficial bacteria every day that we don't even know live on our skin. We don't even know how they may be helping our skin.
So you decided to give this a try.
I did, because I thought, well, the only way to really, you know, understand what they were offering was to see whether it would do anything for me. And of course, you know, the company did not tell me to stop showering and did not tell me to stop using soap and shampoo. I decided to do that because I'm kind of crazy and because I wanted to remove all the variables. I wanted to see what would happen, and I had a time crunch, so I decided to go cold turkey.
Okay, so what happened after week one?
After week one, the most visible change was that my hair got greasy and disgusting. Mm-hmm. I it looked like someone had poured half a jar of honey on it and let it harden. Mm. I couldn't touch my hair but to want to wash my hands, and I did wash my hands with soap. So, you know, clearly their product is not a replacement for shampoo.
Yeah. Okay. And so by the time you get to week four, what is your hair looking like? And what are you looking like and smelling like?
Well, you know, I did have a 3-minute rinse in the shower every day just to feel like a human being, but it was just literally water on my body. So what was happening was my skin started clearing up. It was very interesting. Usually my skin gets very dry in the winter, and it started feeling almost like I was visiting the sauna on a weekly basis. My skin wasn't dry anywhere, and my face, which is prone to hormonal breakouts, was clear. My pores actually shrunk, and I can't attribute that to the product. It could be attributable to the fact that I wasn't using soap on my face for the first time in 33 years, but my hair didn't improve.
Well, I understand that cosmetic companies are now experimenting with the same idea.
The principle is that if we add beneficial bacteria to our skin, we could improve the hydration of our skin. We could even conceivably one day treat skin inflammation, eczema, psoriasis, I think cosmetic companies are starting to see the emerging science of the skin microbiome as an important opportunity, both for sales and to eventually sell probiotic skincare products to dermatologists who might prescribe them to people.
Well, of course, the irony is that what you're saying is using nothing is probably the best thing, because that's the natural skin biome, microbiome.
Well, I wouldn't advise that. I'm not sure if the body will, for instance, clean itself, but our bacteria do play an essential role in sealing the skin, keeping hydration in, and keeping pathogens out. And so, you know, it's interesting. The most common discussion that this article has sparked is, you know, to wash or not to wash. But to me, the larger question is, when we wash, what might our products be doing on a microbial level? One thing that I learned for the story is scientists don't know. No cosmetic company, no one who produces soap or shampoo for the mainstream market is obliged to test our products on a bacterial level. So in other words, we are all guinea pigs right now, with the products we're using, all of us.
Julia Scott, she's a writer and radio producer in San Francisco, and she is very clean. right now. Her article on her soap-free experiment is in this weekend's New York Times Magazine. It's online now, and it happens to be the number one most clicked story there on the website now at newyorktimes.com. Julia, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Coming up, our Friday film segment, our critics take on the new X-Men movie, the new Michael C. Hall, Don Johnson thriller, and the first film in decades from the surreal mind of 85-year-old director Alejandro Jodorowsky. That's next on Press Play.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, which means it's time for film, and we've got a superhero bonanza and a pulpy crime thriller to talk about with Devin Faraci, who runs the pop culture and movies website Badass Digest. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me again.
And a newcomer to the Friday slate, James Rocky. Hi.
Hi, Ms. Brand. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. James Rocky hosts the movie review podcast, The Lunch. Okay, let's start with the biggie. The X-Men are back in theaters this weekend.
How did you lose them? The treatment for my spine affects my DNA.
You sacrificed your powers so you could walk.
What do you know about it?
I've lost my fair share.
Huh. Dry your eyes, Eric. It doesn't justify what you've done.
You've no idea what I've done.
I know that you took the things that mean the most to me.
Well, maybe you should have fought harder for them.
Okay, it sounds very intriguing, Devin. What's this one about?
This one is, it begins in the not-too-distant future where things are really screwed up. So our heroes, the X-Men, send one of their own back in time to the far-distant past of 1973 to stop what's going to get screwed up before it happens. And there he goes back and he meets the younger versions of Professor X and Magneto, the main characters from the X-Men films, who got rebooted in X-Men First Class just a couple of years ago. And if this sounds complicated, it's because it's the seventh film in the series. So it definitely has that sort of building on the continuity of what's come before, and you kind of have to recognize who everybody is.
And in many ways, reshaping that continuity. This is a $250 million effort to shake the etch-a-sketch of a film franchise so they can move forward and go forward with their dream team cast of characters and actors.
Yeah, they're starting over again.
Yeah. And what's with the 70s? Why the 70s?
Well, it's interesting. The original, this storyline in the comics took place in the 1980s, but the earlier X-Men First Class prequel / fourth film took place in the 60s. It gives me a headache just to contemplate it. But the great thing is that, you know, unlike, say, The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which spends hundreds of millions of dollars to perfectly depict a moment that was in a 1973 comic book, this departs from and does a riff on the already printed and written storyline from the comic. So it's not that whole thing of tedious fan service. It's more of, we're going to do a riff on this to tell a story.
Okay, and how is that story? Did you like it?
It's entertaining but flawed.
It's pretty good.
Yeah,
it's pretty good. I mean, this is my rousing.
It's
pretty good. I enjoyed it. You know, it's one of those things where, in terms of blockbuster season, it isn't so overblown as to be numbing. The character work is pretty reasonable. The actors, I think, are really great. Michael Fassbender, James McAvoy, and Jennifer Lawrence, with Hugh Jackman returning as Wolverine. You know, in terms of these kinds of movies, that's a pretty strong cast to have at your center.
It also has a great sense of levity and wit and humor that really lightens the bombast these movies can often tread too heavily in.
Especially the X-Men films, which the first three that Bryan Singer was behind, he's returned for this one. They were real, like, kind
dour,
of dour,
sour, dark hallway.
Taking it real serious. Like, hey, guys, this isn't for kids. This is real important X-Men business. And now they're like, hey, let's have a little bit of fun this time.
And this is the movie that is opening up the summer movie season, right?
I think summer...
Define that. Captain America sort of did.
Summer starts in February now by Hollywood's block.
Yeah, it's kind of like the fire season. It's all year round.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty much.
All right. Next up, some pulpy noir for your Memorial Day weekend. Cold in July.
That is not the guy.
What are we supposed to do now?
Luke Detective Agency.
How far do you want to take this?
Cops are up to something. They use my family as bait. I want to know why.
That That's Michael C. Hall and his mullet. And
yeah, it's too bad we're on radio because you cannot see the most astonishing mullet in cinema history, perhaps.
You know.
Is it better than Billy Ray Cyrus's?
I really think he's giving Billy Ray a run for his money. I honestly do.
And the mullet Oscars.
So this is, the mullet has a purpose because it's set in the 80s.
This is actually an adaptation of a crime novel by Joe R. Lansdale, a great, crafty, underread American crime novelist. It's directed by Jim Mickle, who's made two great horror films, Stakeland and We Are What We Are. And Michael C. Hall plays a perfectly ordinary guy. One night in his Texas home, his wife hears a noise. He goes to see who it is. It is an intruder. And in a startled moment, one shot, one kill. No problem. The authorities don't care, but he does. And that's how he goes down the rabbit hole.
And that's when we get what?
It gets interesting.
Film noir kind of thing?
It begins as sort of a Cape Fear riff where there's a revenge element. There's somebody coming after him and his family. But then it opens up into something a lot larger and a lot seedier and a lot more fun. And then Don Johnson comes in and brings a whole new feel to the entire
Don
movie.
Speaking of the 80s.
Yes.
Don Johnson is a Texas PI with a big car and a bigger attitude. This movie would make a great double bill with Blue Ruin, another independent American noir film that steadfastly refuses to be the movie you think it's going to be and is all the better for it.
And I really hope it does well because Don Johnson's character, this PI with a pig farm who wears these incredible Western shirts, is a returning character in some of these novels. And I'd love to see this character back on screen again. He's a lot of fun.
So if you had to pick between that and the X-Men movie.
It's bourbon versus, what, a Long Island iced tea? They're very different tastes.
Between an Appletini and, and a bourbon, I would say. I would probably go see Cold in July if only because X-Men's going to be there for the next 2.5 months.
Okay, it is time now to talk about Alejandro Jodorowsky. And Devin, you are kind of an expert on him.
Oh, gosh.
He's this 85-year-old filmmaker from Chile who has made his first film in, 23 years?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And it's called Dance of Reality. And just here's a little snippet.
Nunca realidad. Algo nos está soñando. Entrégate a la ilusión. Vive.
Just looking at the trailer for this, I felt like I was in some Fellini Buñuel fantasy.
I mean, that's what he's probably going for. I haven't seen the film. I'm so excited to go see it this weekend. It's exciting to have Jodorowsky back after so long. After his version of Dune fell apart, he kind of fell out of the film business and ended up doing a lot of comic work, really interesting high-end comic work. But now he's back. This movie is apparently very personal, very much about his early life, and also, as many of his films are, obsessed with the tarot.
And has that weird shamanic energy that he's always had in his best films.
Yeah, he definitely did not grow up and become like a middle-class guy. Like, he is now still just as weird as he ever was. So that's pretty nice.
Right, and I saw that documentary that you're featured in.
Jodorowsky's Dune, which is a great film.
Incredible. If you can rent that one or see it somewhere, it's definitely worth seeing. But it's hard to describe exactly who he is or what his films are about. They are just these over-the-top fantasias.
He's the rare example of the guy who has a singular vision and manages to get it on celluloid without even knowing how to compromise. It's so great. It's such great primal, artistic, individual-driven, auteurish stuff, for lack of a better
phrase. And what's nice is that it's not pretentious. He's coming in from a reality just left of our center, and what he's giving us is what he sees. He's not giving us something that he thinks is – he's not trying to blow your mind. This is just what he sees.
Okay, well, speaking of film legends, I guess, Jean-Luc Godard, he unveiled yet another film, perhaps his last, at Cannes this year. And what are we hearing about it?
That it's a 69-minute-long 3D film starring his dog. Hmm. And apparently it's quite wonderful and unique and singular. And, you know, he had filmed Socialism at Cannes a few years ago. I think the idea of him doing a 3D film is, in fact, terrific, just to use those tools however he would most like to.
He apparently uses them in a weird way, because what he's done in a couple of scenes in the movie is he has separated the image from left eye to right eye. So there will be a character who walks off to the left of the screen, and only your left eye will see that character, while the other character walks off to the right side of the screen, and only your right eye will see that character. So it sort of splits it up. This is sort of a gimmicky thing that's been done a couple times in like exploitation films, in Robot Monster. William Castle did a variation on it in 13 Ghosts. It's kind of exciting that Godard comes up and takes this gimmicky use of the two eyes and does something that apparently is particularly stunning.
Devin Faraci runs the pop culture movies website Badass Digest. James Rocky hosts the movie review podcast The Lunch. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you again.
Coming up, Mayor Eric Garcetti joins us to talk about parking tickets, balancing the budget, and being a mayor more concerned with potholes than pie-in-the-sky ideas. That's next after this news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
I'm Madeline Brand. Well, a year ago this week, Eric Garcetti was elected mayor of Los Angeles. Garcetti calls himself LA's back to basics mayor. Some say maybe too basic, so under the radar, we don't know what he's doing. But defenders say his low profile is proof that he's doing exactly what he should be doing, the sometimes unglamorous work of actually managing the city. Well, what has he accomplished so far and what are his priorities? We have him here to answer those questions. And Mayor, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Madeline. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Well, let's start with the most pressing news, and that is you made a bet with Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, that the Kings will beat the Blackhawks in the NHL Western Conference Finals. So what do you get if you win?
Well, I think I get a whole basket full of food from many places in Chicago. But more exciting for me, we get a 3D printout of an LA icon of Chicago's choice. We're both, Rahm Emanuel and I are both proponents of this thing called Summer of Learning, which I'm doing in LA this year for the first time. He did in Chicago last year to promote summertime learning for kids. And a big part of that is getting them ready for the jobs of the future by knowing things like 3D printing. So we bet our students against each other, essentially, to come up with something creative that even as they lose and cry that their hockey team is out of the Stanley Cup, they can make something that'll help their career in the future.
Okay, well, let's talk about the future jobs. You are proposing to cut business taxes. Is that in an attempt to keep businesses in the city? And if so, is that a wise plan given the $240 million deficit?
Well, as of this week, we don't have that deficit. We had my first budget was passed this week by the council. I closed that gap. We did the work that we've been doing every year, balancing the budget. It was projected be over at $1.1 billion if we didn't engage in pension reform, we didn't work with our unions to control healthcare costs, downsize our workforce, and make cuts over the last 5 years. But this year's reserve fund is the largest we've ever seen. We have a balanced budget, and part of the package was to begin to chip away at our city's business tax, because part of the reason I think our budgets have been unbalanced is because we don't have the revenues from business activity as jobs have fled Los Angeles over the last two decades. We're up a million people in population, and we're down over 150,000 jobs over the last 20 years. LA County is up in jobs and up in population. And I think the differentiating factor is the highest business tax in the county was here in LA. So I'm focused on that, just like I'm focused on skills training and helping those who have been left behind. And the proof's been in the pudding so far. We are down, since I'm in office, from an 11.8% unemployment rate to 8.5% just last week. We got those numbers, so down almost 3.5 points in just 10 months. So we've got good things going, but we've got to keep that momentum up.
Now, part of the reason why you have a balanced budget is you're relying on city workers to agree to no pay raises and putting 10% of their pay into healthcare plans. What makes you think they'll agree to do all that?
Well, so far we've had great success in doing that with each of the contracts we've negotiated. And, you know, I've got to hand it to our city unions. When we faced a fiscal cliff a couple of years ago when we faced the really bankruptcy, it was together, I was council president at the time, that they said, because senior workers could have just let us lay people off and it wouldn't have been them since it happens by seniority, they actually stepped up and said, we'll pay more into our pensions, we'll pay more for our health care, we'll pay more to retain these jobs that provide critical city services to the people of LA. So I'm optimistic they understand that we're not out of the recession by any means. Our receipts lag by a year, economic activity in the real world, because we have to collect those taxes during the year. And so they know that, you know, and have agreed to in the first contracts we've had that there won't be raises, but people have jobs. We're going to protect their benefits. And make a small move by, as most people do in the private sector, pay a piece of our healthcare premiums, just 10%, which is much lower than on the private side, to ensure that those jobs are safe, to ensure those city services are protected. I thank them for what they've done already to be a partner in this.
But if they don't decide to go along with this, then what happens to your balanced budget?
Well, if we didn't get that, we would face the same menu of choices in the past, layoffs, furloughs, things like that, that in the past have really hurt not only the workers, but more importantly, or as importantly for all of us, the city services we depend on. And so I'm very optimistic that people know that the right path forward is doing this together, hand in hand, to collaborate. And again, the proof's in the pudding. The first few contracts we've negotiated with the mayor have included that health care and or 0% raises. The DWP, for instance, workers got raises for the last 20 years, and we signed an agreement for 3 years without a raise. And that was a pretty historic step.
One thing that you relied on for your balanced budget was substantial revenue from parking tickets. And a lot of people got really angry about that. And you wanted to hire part-time traffic officers to write parking tickets to bring in more revenue. City Council cut back on that plan. Did you miscalculate the anger that people had over paying pretty substantial fines when it comes to parking tickets and the anger that they have that the city's finances shouldn't be balanced on the backs of people who have to drive and park?
No, I actually agree 100%. And when we worked closely with the council to make those changes that had kind of been put in the budget, there was no new quotas for parking tickets. There was no greater revenue that was seen to be derived. The only change that was made is we had a lot of people being paid overtime to do the traffic direction when there's construction, to make sure when there's special events like Lakers or Clippers games, that was being done in a much less cost-efficient way because we were paying overtime to people instead of hiring some temporary workers. But what we worked with the council to do is to hire a few more permanent people, which will save taxpayer money, which doesn't boost the parking ticket rates 1 cent. And more importantly, I've sat down with a lot of the folks who I talked to during the campaign, who I agree with, as we've seen soaring parking tickets going. Is there a smarter way that this can be less of a gotcha mentality of trying to get revenues and change it instead to a parking as a commodity where we can give you a text on your phone, your meter's about to run out, would you like a little bit more money, and it can deduct from an account where if you stay an extra hour, maybe the rate goes up a little bit, but instead of a parking ticket for, sometimes as people collect them hundreds of dollars, we can have, a couple more bucks, which helps us with our city budget, but not in a way that really criminalizes or goes after people. And to me, for working families, for working people who have gotten those tickets, it's been too much. You can't change that overnight because you have critical city services that come from revenues, but we didn't raise that one bit this year.
Well, on the other hand, you want to provide an incentive for people to take public transportation, and there's probably no greater incentive than the cost of driving and the cost of parking.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of great work on this. Don Shoup, who's a professor at UCLA, said there's a high cost for cheap parking. But we also want to support neighborhood businesses. I think it's a balance. And I've put a lot of focus on public transit in my first 10 months. We just came back from Washington, D.C. We got $2.1 billion from the federal government to extend the Wilshire subway. Earlier in the year, we had our first grant in 17 years from the federal government for the downtown subway connector to get all of those lines that go east-west and north-south to connect so you can stay in one seat all the way from Long Beach to Pasadena, soon from the ocean all the way to the east side. But when the Expo line opens up next year, that'll be a game changer for folks on the west side to come downtown. And we broke ground on the Crenshaw line. So we're really looking at a lot of good options for people to make sure every car trip we can take off the road is good for those who have to stay on the road, as well as those who find their way to public transit.
So Senator Feinstein, who was also at that event in Washington with you, said she'll believe it when she sees it in terms of Angelinos getting out of their cars.
I think she said we have glue affixed to our rear ends and our car seats. But I told her, it's a changed landscape now. Every line that we've opened up has exceeded our ridership. The Orange Line, which is the rapid bus in the valley, is triple what the expectations are.
Okay, speaking on a similar theme, let's talk about walking. And some of our streets are really a mess. I think we have around 4,600 miles of damaged sidewalks. So what are you doing to fix them?
Well, we extended, we more than doubled the budget this year. That kind of back-to-basics agenda that you mentioned is really about core services, putting more tree trimming out there, paving more streets, the most we've ever done, and doubling the amount that we're going to put into our sidewalk repairs. That's critical, but you're right. We have such a huge backlog that even doubling it will only kind of slow down the decay rather than actually turn the tide. My colleagues on the city council, Joe Buscano and Mitch Englander, have looked at an initiative potentially for this year's ballot to save our streets, which would, you know, for about 35 bucks a year in sales tax from the average person, you could save, if you drive right now, the estimated over $600 a year you pay just to repair your car from the broken up streets. So I'm looking at that.
Okay, finally, I want to ask you, best taco, where is it? And best pastrami, where is it?
What kind of taco? I think my favorite cochinita pibil taco, which is like the nice marinated pork, is definitely at Yucca's, which is in Los Feliz, uh-huh, Hollywood area. And then the best pastrami. The best pastrami sandwich is Langer's. The best pastrami itself is Brent's out in Northridge.
And how do you think Langer stacks up to New York City delis?
Oh, we destroy New York. There's actually a book put out by my friend David Sachs that ranked all the delis in the country, and they said New York has long been passed by or overpassed by Los Angeles. We now have the best delis, more of them. New York's closing them down. We're actually opening them up. We are the deli king of America.
All right. Mayor Eric Garcetti, thanks for the time.
You bet. Great to be with you.
Them's fighting words, pastrami wars between LA and New York.
Competing with Jonathan Gold. Seems to know his places.
We're in all news here. In place, in situ, to tell us what's coming up at 1 o'clock.
Vladimir Putin went to China, made a deal there about natural gas. Probably not a very good deal for Russia, but something that will be very helpful to him with regard to the sanctions that he faces. We're going to be talking about that and also about his attitude toward the election that's coming up on Sunday in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. All of this could really make a big difference in the way the world is organized. And we heard about that. It's very fascinating.
Okay, we're going to look forward to that in about 15 minutes from now, 1 o'clock, and To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, we're going to have more on the mayor and how he compares to New York's new mayor, Bill de Blasio. That's coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, Eric Garcetti is not the only new big city mayor. New Yorkers took a sharp and, to many people, surprising left turn last November when they chose liberal Bill de Blasio to run the city.
I've spoken throughout this campaign about a tale of two cities. That inequality, that feeling of a few doing very well, while so many slip further behind. That is the defining challenge of our times.
De Blasio harnessed New Yorkers' frustrations with the Giuliani-Bloomberg era, criticizing the city's growing income inequality, aggressive policing tactics, and lack of affordable housing. Well, New York and LA are very different cities with a kind of love-hate relationship. So what about their new mayors? Joining me now to do a little comparison are Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Hi, Rafe.
Hello, Madeline.
And Michael Grinbaum. He's City Hall Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Okay, let's first start off with that pastrami war comment. Eric Garcetti said L.A. has better delis than New York. What do you think about that?
Well, it just so happens that Katz's Deli, which I would call the gold standard of the New York sandwich scene, was flooded this week because of a water main breakdown on Houston Street.
Oh, no.
So this just happens to be a bad time for New York right now in the deli scene. But I'm going to say that after they patch that up, we retain the crown.
Okay. All right. Well, to be continued, let's talk about what you just heard. You heard my interview with Mayor Garcetti. And I'm wondering, how would it have sounded different if I were interviewing Bill de Blasio?
Well, I thought that clip of his speech with the that echo in the background, I was envisioning kind of the Citizen Kane photograph behind him. He has a very grand rhetorical style, some gripe that it perhaps is a bit overheated. But Bill de Blasio, both in his campaign and since coming into office, has really tried to make what is sort of a job seen as a municipal steward into really a springboard to fight these societal ills that we face. He's laid out these grand ambitions to combat social inequality in New York City, and he's often he's laid out grand plans, and he often focuses on those bigger issues rather than we heard Mayor Garcetti talking more about parking revenue and sort of new apps to text people when their meter is about to run out. That's the type of technocratic approach that Michael Bloomberg took, but that we have not seen so far from de Blasio.
So de Blasio has a grander vision and is not concerned with the so-called back to basics agenda that Garcetti has talked about?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, so Mayor de Blasio inherited a city that some might say has never, you know, been better. The crime is at historic lows. Life expectancy is higher than ever before. Streets are clean. I mean, people feel safe. Obviously, that's fueled a rising real estate market, gentrification across the city. And there is certainly a swath of the population that did not benefit from those gains of the Bloomberg years. But because he doesn't have to focus on crime, because some of those nitty-gritty issues are at the moment quite good, it's sort of given de Blasio this opening to instead focus on those bigger social issues that I mentioned.
And Rafe, do you think Eric Garcetti is making a mistake by not focusing on those larger social issues that de Blasio is?
No, I think it's a different context. I think that there's nothing radical about saying you're against inequality in Los Angeles. The liberal side pretty much won that argument, starting with Tom Bradley's election in 1973. It's a much more progressive city historically in the last 20, 30, 40 years than New York City. And I think de Blasio did the challenge that needed to happen in New York, which was to introduce a more progressive view into a city that's been more of a center-right governance. I think that Eric Garcetti is also reacting to the Antonio Villaraigosa predecessor, in that Antonio Villaraigosa was a big visionary and had lots of stuff, and he was on your TV set. It sometimes felt like he was so hot that he was burning the wires, if there's an analogy there somehow. Probably more in the New York style of mayors. LA mayors are quieter. And the biggest complaint, to parallel what's been working in New York, is that basic services have been seen as not working in LA. So in some ways, the unfinished work in LA is the basic stuff that visionaries tend to miss. Now, down the road, though, A, he'd better deliver on that, because that can be measured. And B, down the road, he is going to have to be more visionary. But I think this is a good start. He'll be tested much harder down the road about whether people can agree on the cost of building subways and other things and the construction that goes on. And will there be more traffic than not less? That could be very serious for the mayor.
Michael, you mentioned at the outset of this that there's a water main break on Houston Street, flooding Katz's Deli. So it seems like the mayor should maybe look at these nitty-gritty issues, which perhaps aren't so nitty-gritty.
We had an awful building collapse up in East Harlem where several people were killed just a few months ago, and that was due to a faulty gas vein. De Blasio actually had not yet appointed a new buildings commissioner. Now, he's been very slow in assembling his government, and they managed to kind of navigate that. But there's a lot of pressing questions about infrastructure that people have not heard many details from this mayor. And in fact, I want to say that all of this rhetoric that de Blasio has used and sort of these big themes that he's laid out, the rap on him that's emerging is that he has not yet really backed that up with a whole lot of detail. He put out a plan to build or preserve 200,000 units of affordable housing over the next 10 years. But his organizers were quite vague on the specifics of how they were actually going to get that done in a city where that's long been a challenge. The same goes with a deal that he just cut with the teachers union, which is going to put the city on the hook for billions of dollars of retroactive pay over the next 10 years. The city really still has not put out weeks later some of the very specific budget numbers, the balance sheet numbers that a lot of fiscal experts want to see. So what's emerging as kind of an early question of de Blasio's tenure is whether or not he can back up these big plans with the expertise and the nitty-gritty, to use that phrase, that's required of running a municipality.
All right. I want to spend a little time talking about the wives of these two mayors. And Michael, earlier this week, you wrote a story with the headline, De Blasio tells city's tabloids to apologize to his wife. And here he is at a press conference saying that.
I think they owe all of us an apology for absolutely misrepresenting what she said and for caricaturing, you know, a reality that I think so many women face.
Okay, so Shirlane McRae is Bill de Blasio's wife, and she's the subject of a cover article in New York Magazine where she talks about her ambivalence about being a mom, and then the tabloids just seized on it. Is that right?
Yes. She spoke about some of the complex emotions she felt when she first had a daughter later in life. She was about 40. And also that when her daughter was born, she didn't want to fully give up her independence and her professional life, and sometimes looked for excuses not to spend time with her daughter.
So why is de Blasio making such a big deal out of this and actually calling a press conference to talk about it?
Yes. Well, the New York Post seized on that and put a headline up saying, "I'm a bad mom," with a big picture of Miss McRae on the cover, which was roundly criticized, although not wholly unsurprising for an institution like the Post, which is often a provocateur in the New York media scene. It's unusual for a mayor to kind of not let that thing roll off his back and actually actively demand an apology to his family. But his advisors believe they needed to put a mark in the sand and try to use this as put him on the side of other mothers who maybe empathized with the First Lady's experience.
Right. And in fact, he used his family quite effectively to get elected in the first place.
What's fascinating is that his family is really a huge part of his public persona. I mean, he's had no qualms about putting them at the forefront of campaign ads. His wife attends many press conferences with him now as mayor, and he appointed her to a role in the city government, unpaid, although. So what's interesting is that he's very eager to put his family out in the public eye, but sometimes it doesn't come out quite the way he wants, and he often bristles and then attacks the media for the way they've handled it.
And Rafe, here in Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti's wife, Amy Wakeland, she was also involved in the campaign, but she has a very, very low profile.
She does, and that's typical of Los Angeles. We don't show much interest in the families of the elected officials, and sometimes we don't show that much interest in the elected officials as well. We've got plenty of celebrities in town. We can worry about the Lakers families and the Clippers families and movie stars, and there's so much less of the kind of tabloid-style coverage of politics. Sometimes people in politics say, "Why don't you pay more attention to me in L.A.?" You know, in New York City, there seems to be more of a benefit of sort of taking a verbal punch or maybe an actual punch at somebody who criticizes a family member. Here, I think you probably let it go off your back and hope it doesn't get a whole lot of traction. It's just a whole different stance toward politics here. It's so much more low-key in Los Angeles than in New York.
So what if we switched mayors? What do you think the effect would be, Rafe?
Well, I've thought about that a lot. And if I could go back a mayor or two, I think if Antonio Villaraigosa was in New York City, he'd be right in the mainstream in terms of style. He'd be on the news every day. He'd be going to the Yankee games wearing a Yankee hat, going to the Met games wearing a Met hat. If there were scandals, they would be fascinating and everybody would love it. He'd have big ambitions, then people would be mad at him all the time, but he'd be the talk of the town. I think that Eric Garcetti is perfectly suited for L.A., but in New York City, they might say, well, he's too low-key. And I think there's the possibility that de Blasio coming out here, people would say, what are you talking about? We already talk about inequality all the time. This is the biggest labor city in the United States. You know, 90% of our conversation is inequality. You might have to go to the back of the line and not really have much of an impact. I also think we'd have interesting questions about pastrami if they switch. I have eaten at Katz's, and I did think it was absolutely wonderful. But I agree with Mayor Garcetti. I think the deli stuff out here is just fabulous. I'm from New Jersey originally.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. We started with pastrami, and we're ending with pastrami. Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA, and Michael Grinbaum is City Hall Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jolie Myers, all this talk of pastrami is making me hungry.
I could eat a bathtub full of Brent's pastrami right now. Just like get in below it and eat my way out.
First, you have to go through the mail, though, and then you can do that.
Yeah, I'll wait till tomorrow to go ahead and do that. So we did have this conversation with Mayor Garcetti earlier in the show, and we asked you on Facebook, what's an issue you want the city to focus on that's not getting a lot of attention right now? Robert Plata says road quality. Then he was unceremonially swallowed by a pothole on Western in Koreatown.
Oh, no.
Sorry, Robert. Eric Medina says the sidewalks need attention. He's sick of seeing wheelchairs in the streets because the sidewalks are so jacked up. And Javier Robles says gentrification and affordable rent need some love. It's getting too expensive to even live in the city. So he wanted to address the mayor now while he could before he gets pushed out of the city and it's no longer his mayor. Yesterday, we talked about segregation in LA schools, and we got a lot of comments from you folks. Barefoot in the Park commented on our blog. She or he says that the question of segregated schools in LA is a question of funding. She says, why not put all of the funds in one pot and divide it evenly? How hard is that? Oh, that's right. We can't do that because that would be fair. I sense a little sarcasm from Barefoot in the Park. And Maria Lauren commented on Facebook. She said, Blacks and Latinos are the highest population in the prison system, foster care, and first in unemployment. We have to understand that there are ripple effects to segregated schools, ripple effects that cost all taxpayers money later on. So lots of reaction from you guys on that story.
Yeah, and keep it coming. There are lots of ways to comment. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. You can leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. We're also on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. I am at The Mad Brand. Jolie Myers, have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you. I will. I'll enjoy the 3-day weekend. It's very exciting. That's it for me. And I want everyone to have just a fantastic weekend. I'll see you on Monday.